Hi everyone, and welcome to the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han, and you might have noticed that we've had quite a lot of Remainers on this far. That's why this week we wanted to burst our political bubble and bring on David Curtin, who is a London Assembly member for UKIP. My trusty co-host Tim Hemming talked to him about what part the Independence Party still has to play after the referendum, as well as about the downfall of Labour and why he doesn't think climate change is alarming despite being a former chemistry teacher. You might not agree with what he has to say, but I think especially in light of our increasingly polarised political spectrum, this episode is well worth a listen. If you enjoy this show, please rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice, because that's how people find out about us and it really helps us out. You can also find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at brexitpodcast.
It's a warm welcome to David Curtin from UKIP, who is our next guest. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you very much.
Right, let's go straight in at the deep end. Now, UKIP have one MP. The EU vote obviously is now, you know, the UK are leaving. The Tories are taking on the grammar school role. Isn't it job done for UKIP? I mean, what part have you got left to play?
Well, a lot of people have been saying that since the day of the referendum, but clearly it's not job done for UKIP. We're not out of the European Union yet. We have 17.4 million people who voted for Brexit. And before the referendum, David Cameron, who was the Prime Minister at the time, said that he would trigger Article 50 on the very next day, on June the 24th. But that didn't happen. In fact, exactly the opposite has happened. He resigned. Then there was a period of chaos and confusion. The Conservative Party eventually got its act together and got Theresa May as the Prime Minister. But she's now saying that Article 50 is not going to be triggered until March. So a full 9 months after everybody expected, and now there's the delay. There, you know, the opponents of Brexit have gone to court and are challenging even the government's ability and authority to trigger Article 50. So UKIP really do have a very vital and big role to play in the country to make sure that we do get Brexit and that we do get a full Brexit, which is what people voted for.
Now, you're right, there have been court challenges and there are further court challenges, and there is a lot of talk about not such a hard Brexit and it taking quite a long time to come to fruition. Mm. Your thoughts on that?
Well, absolutely. This is the case. This is where we find ourselves at the moment, at the beginning of December, nearly 6 months after the referendum. And I think that people are getting restless and getting, you know, quite concerned, to say the least, about the delays. People voted for Brexit for some simple reasons, because we want this country to be sovereign, so that we want our laws to be made in Westminster and not Brussels, so that we can make our own trade deals, so that we can control our borders and reduce immigration to a reasonable level, which is what Theresa May and David Cameron have been saying for years and years. But all the time they've been saying it, levels of net immigration have gone up and up and up, and there's no doesn't seem to be any movement or any action to be able to reduce that. And also people voted because we want to stop paying homage to Brussels and giving net £10 billion a year to the European Commission. So all of those things are the main reasons why people voted to leave the European Union. So we call that hard Brexit. If we get a soft Brexit, none of those things are going to happen. It will essentially be meaningless. And so people are getting very, very concerned and restless that people are not going to get the Brexit that we voted for.
Yeah, you talked there about immigration, and it's obviously a very emotive subject and one that people potentially, you know, cast their votes on. I mean, do we really know, though, the impact of sort of migration both in and out of the UK?
Well, at the moment, I mean, I'm a London Assembly member. I'm based in London, and I think most people in London would agree that the city has got ever more crowded since the beginning of the millennium in 2000. The population of the country as a whole is increasing hugely, and some people have a very nice experience of immigration if they're working in a very high-salaried, high-end job, perhaps in financial services or something where you sort of mix in your own little bubble with people that are all earning similarly high salaries. But that's a very, very small part of the country. And normal people, ordinary everyday people like builders and fishermen and carpenters and joiners and painters and decorators, find that for many of these jobs, in many areas, wages are being squeezed. Even the Bank of England Chief Mark Carney said that in a report. Even Stuart Rose, who was leading the Britain Stronger in Europe, said that immigration leads to wage compression. It leads to salaries, wages going down for ordinary people. But he said that's not necessarily a bad thing. Well, it's not for him, because he's sitting on top of a big company and gets a bigger salary for himself by not being able to pay normal wages for a normal working people. Also, we see the cost of housing increases as you have much greater demand for housing, but we're not building houses anywhere near enough a rate to cope with the flow of immigration. So, we've never said that immigration is a bad thing. It just needs to be controlled. It needs to be in balance, and it's got so out of balance that it's affecting the lives, the quality of life, and the standard of living of millions and millions of ordinary people that the London metropolitan bubble has got completely out of touch with.
Is there not an argument to say that it's actually improving the lives of people, though? We have a shortage of doctors and nurses in this country, and we bring in vital skills from abroad. Similarly, when I spoke to Minette Battis from the National Farmers Union, she said that seasonal migrants for seasonal employment in the agricultural industry was absolutely critical.
Well, absolutely, and this is why we need a sensible immigration policy. I mean, I'm in UKIP, and we've always argued for an Australian-style points-based system for immigration, where if there are areas of the economy where we need skilled workers to come in to the country, for example, like doctors, perhaps like IT professionals, and also seasonal workers, to come in and pick the harvest in rural areas, then we can have an immigration and a visa system that allows that to happen. But when it's not controlled, when anyone can come for any reason and compete for any job, that may be harmful and detrimental to the chances and opportunities of British people. And also another thing I would say is that this country has in many ways de-skilled, because we have free movement of people throughout the European Union. And I don't blame any individual person for wanting to come to Britain and try to make the most of the opportunities. But when businesses, especially larger businesses, can employ someone from another country who's been trained in another country, then they will do that, perhaps in preference to taking the time to invest in training in our own British young people. And so one effective mass migration and free movement is that British young people have not been skilled up and have got a huge skills deficit and a skills gap as well.
Is there not a wider picture to this, though, that is more worrying, in that if we just see ourselves as British and quite insular, then the foreigners who are over here, over in the UK at the moment and working, and I spoke to an Italian lawyer, for example, two nights ago, and she was saying the day after the EU referendum vote, she felt scared and she felt like she was not wanted. And the divisiveness that comes with a UKIP policy of a hard Brexit. Is that not a bigger worry all across the board?
Well, no, not at all. I mean, and what we've said, and what I think most people from the Leave side of the Brexit argument have said, that anyone who's here, you know, before the referendum would be, you know, a European Union citizens would be allowed to stay. I mean, there's no question of being unwelcoming to people who are already here. I mean, the general consensus is, if you're here, you're here, you know, because there are British people also living in the European Union. So that's a practical quid pro quo. But I mean, you people have feelings go up and feelings go down, but you know, obviously lots of people feel different things because as a result. I was very happy myself, and I was outside Parliament on the 24th of June, the day after the referendum, and I was very happy that we've got the vote to be able to get our country back in a way and be able to make our own laws and decide our own destiny. But it's not the case that we're going to be insular. I mean, one of the reasons we've come out of the European Union, or want to, is so that we can make trade deals with all countries around the world and not be held back by being in the single market, in the customs union, which stops us from making trade deals and doing more business with countries like China, Australia, Brazil, and so on. So it's not to do with being insular. It's actually, you know, one sort of meme phrase, you like, is out of Europe into the world. We're geographically in Europe, but really out of the European Union, which is not the same as Europe. Love the countries of Europe, visit the countries of Europe. We'll still be partners and do business with people and countries in Europe. We just want to come out of the bureaucracy, which is the European Union, and that's a different thing.
But rightly or wrongly, there are individuals that do attach themselves and align themselves to Europe who are xenophobic and who do not like foreigners. And what's your view when your party is linked with people like that?
Well, it's not linked with people like that. We are really the only party that actually has in our constitution that if you've ever been a member of one of these far-right parties, which are very, very nasty, the BNP, the EDL, and so on, that you are not allowed to join UKIP if you've ever been a member of any of those parties. They do exist, but we are nothing to do with them whatsoever.
Okay, thank you. Now, your own personal motivations for joining UKIP, you've got an interesting background I was talking to you about, but what are some of the key tenets for your own position, I suppose?
Well, I've been a teacher for many, many years, 15 years before I got actively involved in politics, and I've taught in this country, in the UK, and I've taught around the world, you know, in Eastern Europe and also Africa and North America and Asia as well. So I've got a very nice background of traveling and seeing
Bosnia, Botswana, Hampshire, New York.
Yes, yeah, lots of different places. Also, I've traveled and I've seen lots of different places of the world and very, very much enjoyed it. And one of the things that I really was concerned about, you know, as well as the European Union, was this huge trade deal which was going through between the European Union and the USA called TTIP. And on the other side of the world, you know, the United States was doing a similar deal with Asian countries called the TPP. And interesting, a lot of people on the left of politics in this country, but more especially in European countries like Germany and France, were protesting about this in very, very large numbers, because people were worried that there was going to be a system of corporate courts set up whereby global multinational corporations would be able to sue individual nation states if they made new laws or introduced new legislation which might affect their future profits. So, I mean, I'm very concerned about the sovereignty of passing from Westminster to Brussels, but this seemed to be another level of removal of sovereignty from the people, and sovereignty would pass from Brussels to corporate courts, which would allow very, very large businesses to have a legal personality which would be more powerful than nation states. And so that would be an even greater removal of sovereignty sovereignty and a greater removal of power from the people. I just thought that that's wrong. It's wrong to give power to Brussels without asking the people properly, and it's even more wrong to then give that power away to corporations. And so that's one of the reasons I got involved in politics.
How's the situation with that now? I think most people would find it quite scary.
Well, interestingly,
is with big business.
Well, interestingly, you know, the people that have killed that really is actually Donald Trump becoming president in the United States. He's saying, you know, I'm going to scrub out TTIP and I'm going to scrub out TPP. And, you know, UKIP has put a lot of pressure on in the European Parliament as well. And so, interestingly, it's a lot of people on the left of politics who are concerned about it, but it's been really Farage and Trump who have done the most to actually stop this removal of sovereignty and giving it to the large corporations. And really, I think truly, they are, you know, heroes who have stood up for ordinary people, small and medium-sized businesses, against the global money power establishment, and really are, you know, heroes for freedom and liberty. And that's why I joined UKIP, and I'm very, very glad to see that, you know, not just coming out of the European Union, but we've actually put to bed for the moment some of these trade things that are masquerading as trade deals, but really would take away a lot of freedom from individual people and nation states.
So Farage gets your tip as UK ambassador to the States then?
Well, you know, he's not the leader of UKIP anymore since the earlier last week. Paul Nuttall was the leader. I think, you know, I'm very, very happy for him to do whatever he wants to do. But I think he's still around, and he's helping people in other countries to, you know, make their own referenda as well to leave the European Union. But I think he's got a bright future ahead of him. I don't know if he'll be an ambassador, but I'm sure he can be whatever he wants to be.
Now, a little closer to home, you run up against Harriet Harman in the last year's general election. You got
7%
of the event. She's been a long incumbent position there. Camberwell and Peckham, I believe. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. Camberwell and Peckham.
What did you, 4.7%, is that a trouncing? Were you happy with that? How do you think you can hold her to account?
Well, it was a very, very difficult seat. It was the first time I actually stood in an election. It was my baptism by fire in a very, very tough seat. Obviously, she went on then to become the leader of the Labour Party. She was the deputy leader of the Labour Party, but then when Ed Miliband stood down, she was the interim leader for a few months. So I was really going up against someone who was in a very, very safe seat. So actually, I was hoping to get my deposit back and get 5%, though I was disappointed that I was just a little bit below 5%. But, you know, if you compare that to some of the neighbouring constituencies in that part of South London, I did better than some of them. But, you know, that's small comfort to me. But it's been, you know, for me, in a way, I did that, and now I went on to stand to be a candidate for UKIP in the London Assembly elections, and I'm very happy that a year after that, I was elected with Peter Whittle. And so now we have, for the first time in 11 years or so, two UKIP members on the London Assembly. So from that, sad defeat in 2015, we bounced back to victory in 2016. So it wasn't all bad.
You mentioned, you did briefly touch there on Harman being in charge of the Labour Party for a while. Mm. Now, see, the Tories, when Cameron stood down, that looked from the outside to be quite a debacle for a while. Labour seemed to be forever trying to oust Jeremy Corbyn from within. Mm. The UKIP, with Diane James taking over, and that's a bit of a shambles, I might put to you. What is it with leaderships of our political parties? And it must be eroding the trust of the public, isn't it?
Well, you know, after the referendum, everything was thrown up in the air, and now the cards are landing in a completely different place. So you had the Conservative Party for a while, as you say, in disarray. They got their act together. The Labour Party don't seem to have got their act together even now. Jeremy Corbyn, but there's still a lot of people who are very, very unhappy with them, and they're hemorrhaging their voters and supporters outside the liberal metropolitan elite of the party in London, which again is very, very much out of touch with the traditional Labour working heartlands, and the party is really split in two, and I really don't rate its chances of survival in the long term very much if it continues down the road it's going. Yes, UKIP didn't have a good few months. It was a situation in August, September, October, which was not the best for the party, to be honest. But now we have a leader, again, with Paul Nuttall. He's very, very popular. He was the deputy leader for 6 years, and so he's very well liked and very well known, and there's an incredible positivity and energy around him and the party, and really it's kind of taken on a new lease of life now we've actually got that issue sorted out of the leadership. So I think we in UKIP do have a very bright future.
Although he is no fan of global warming, and you are a long-standing chemistry teacher, so what are your views on that?
Well, I mean, global warming, people used to call it global warming, and then, of course, since 1998, there hasn't been global warming. The temperatures have sort of stayed the same, and so people now call this climate change. Well, you know, there's always climate change, and what I would say is, since the beginning of the middle of the last ice age, 23,000 years ago, temperatures in the Earth have been warming up, and, you know, that's through no human activity whatsoever. All the ice that went down to the south of France melted. And so, you know, it's not just human activity that can cause climate change. But there's no question that carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have increased since the Industrial Revolution. The question is whether they're totally responsible for average global temperatures increasing or decreasing, or partially responsible, or whether there's something else at all. So I'm not a climate change alarmist. There is climate change. I think carbon dioxide levels have contributed somewhat to that, but we also need to take into account other possible factors that are affecting it, such as the solar activity and all sorts of other things. The Earth is a very complicated system. So I don't like the sensationalist media headlines that come out of, you know, very pedestrian scientific observations and very pedestrian, unsensational scientific inquiry sometimes gets leveraged to make a sensational story in the media, and then we do all kinds of things which actually are far more detrimental to the environment than helpful. So we need to be very, very careful about what we do.
But wouldn't membership of the European Union at least keep what is happening with climate change around the world as a priority, whereas the danger if we come out and become independent, we just disregard that whilst we drive to get our economy back on track?
Well, not at all. You have China and you have the United States of America. You have India, rapidly industrializing. So, you know, whatever we do is going to be dwarfed by anything that China does, being, you know, a rapidly industrializing economy as well, and apparently opening 3 coal-fired power stations every week. And China is changing and doing things. It's moving away from that slowly. But, what we've had in the past 40 years or so is we've outsourced all of our environmental law to Europe, to Brussels, and so we just simply haven't been making environmental law of our own. When it's made in Brussels, it doesn't take into account local conditions and local needs in this country of local communities, needs to dredge rivers, for example, and therefore you end up sometimes with flooding, which you wouldn't have if you've been able to look after to your own waterways in a way that local people have been doing for centuries because of the Water Framework Directive of the European Union, for example. Another example of something which I think is disastrous is the Large Combustion Plant Directive, where we've been forced to close all of our coal fired power stations, but the largest one, Drax, has converted to burn wood pellets because they're not allowed to burn coal anymore. We still need the energy. So what we're doing is we're cutting down vast swathes of woodland in North and South America, shipping them across the Atlantic, turning them into wood pellets and burning them. So that's causing huge deforestation on the other side of the world simply because of a European directive that says we're not allowed to burn coal. You know, so we're doing one good thing, but what we're doing to replace it is even worse. And so the European Union is not always good at actually trying to solve environmental problems. There's all sorts of unintended consequences because some of these directives are very, very badly thought out.
Did Margaret Thatcher not try and shut us down on coal years ago?
Well, she did, and also, you know, Harold Wilson before her as well closed down some pits as well. That's in the 80s, so I'm not going to get into, you know, the rights and wrongs of that.
Sure.
That's happened in times past. You know, where we are now, we need energy. My personal view, I think that the thing we need to do in the short term is go for gas, because gas is cleaner than coal. It doesn't produce as much carbon dioxide emissions as coal. In the long term, yes, then we can, well, medium term, we can go perhaps nuclear. In the long term, there will be other solutions with technologies that we don't have yet, such as thorium, nuclear power. Solar and wind at the moment just don't provide enough energy. It's far too intermittent and it's far too expensive for people to actually buy, particularly for working, struggling families. So in the future, maybe, you know, decades to come, we will have technology that is, you know, cheap and clean, but we're nowhere near that at the moment. So we still need to be burning coal to provide, not coal, gas to provide our energy needs, and then we need to move away from that. But sort of any, you know, that's going to be a long-term strategy.
On the struggling families topic, since the EU referendum, pound seems to have gone down. Well, it has gone down. Prices seem to be shooting up in supermarkets. There does seem to be levels of pain there for hard, honest working families, which perhaps had we all voted to remain, we wouldn't be experiencing.
Well, you just don't know, do you? And the pound goes up and the pound goes down. It's gone down. Now it's going up again in the last 2 or 3 weeks. It's recovered. And it's had one of the biggest rises it's had for a long time. I think the talk of prices going up in the shops are very much overplayed. We do have some price rises from some products which are sourced from abroad. But similarly, then you have some British exporters can sell more to foreign countries. So you have some companies that are making, you know, more profits and doing more business. So, you know, when we have a floating currency against all others, it's up and down. But, you know, also the dollar is very, very strong at the moment. You know, then the dollar is very strong, not just against the pound, but also against the euro, against the yen, against the Mexican peso, and also and a basket of other currencies. So it's not simply because of the pound. It's also the strength of the dollar in the international markets. And that's a global thing, which you can't blame on Brexit.
Now, Warren, who is one of the co-founders of our podcast, he runs a small food exporting business. Now, his exports in Europe, he finds that quite seamless. You know, going through EU rules, that's not a problem. When he's tried to set up in the States, he's had an awful lot of difficulty getting through sort of food standards authorities over there. He fears that he has a genuine fear that it may get worse. And can you reassure him in any way?
Well, I think if we do come out of the European Union, then we will make a trade deal with the United States. And I think Donald Trump is very, very much, you know, President-elect Trump is a very big fan of this country. And whereas Obama said, well, Britain will be at the back of the queue, Donald Trump is saying, well, Britain will be at the front of the queue. And he wants to be us to be one of the first countries that he does a good trade deal with. So I think with Mr. Farage, and I think with President Trump, Trump, there will be a lot better opportunities and more opportunities to do business much more easily with the United States.
Thank you. Just a quick couple of ones to finish. A term that's been used a lot now is post-truth politics, which I think really just means lies. The last couple of campaigns that we've seen, the EU referendum, we've also seen what's happened with Trump versus Clinton in the States. There's been quite a lot of half-truths and untruths spoke from all sides, I think. Just for you now as a politician, is that worrying for you yourself? And I think there's a way we can get past that, because clearly you say something a few times and these soundbites do stick with the public.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually question a lot of the reporting in the mainstream media. You can just see it with the polls which have come out before Brexit, the polls which came out before the presidential election were completely wrong. And you had, you know, outlets, mainstream media outlets pushing the fact Hillary's going to win by a landslide, it's going to be Remain by a landslide, and both times that was wrong. So, you know, I do think a lot of reporting in the mainstream media here really has been quite one-sided.
Do you think there's too much of a political agenda with the media?
I think there is quite a liberal political agenda, and you know, Andrew Marr summed it up perfectly a couple of years ago. He said the BBC is full of people who are young, metropolitan, and liberal. And obviously, so if you have a large percentage of people of a certain demographic, there's going to be an innate bias in the reporting and the, how they see the world. So I think that is the issue, that the, in the a lot of the media is based in metropolitan centres, obviously London, New York. York, it's in Los Angeles, etc. So it's going to have a lot of metropolitan liberal people working in it. So it will have that kind of bias. And I think, you know, they've really got a job to do to actually represent conservative viewpoints, to represent the opposite viewpoints fairly and impartially.
But would you also level that then at the Daily Mail from the other side?
Well, indeed. I mean, you've got you need to make sure that you fact check everything, and you know, everything stacks up when you make a report. So you have. I was talking in my previous answer more about television broadcasting outlets, but then you have newspapers on the other side. As a scientist, I want to know the truth, so I try to look at things from every side, look at all the angles, and then come to a reasonable conclusion. And I do think that I'm in UKIP because I think it's a party that speaks a lot of sense and does try to look at things objectively, which is why I joined.
David, thanks. Just finally, is there anything you're going to miss about Europe?
There's not much I'm going to miss about the European Union, but Europe will still be there. Europe is wonderful and beautiful and fantastic and diverse. I love Europe and the countries of Europe. They're still going to be there. We're still going to be friends and partners with the countries and peoples of Europe. But the bureaucracy in the European Union, it's time for that to go.
As always, thanks for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice so you'll be notified whenever we upload a new episode and you'll be able to tune in. In the meantime, you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at brexitpodcast. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, and Warren Paul, and our theme song is Cool Vibes by Kevin MacLeod.